Way Around. Flannery O'Connor. Frustration. Too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart. William Butler Yeats. Country roads. We're going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business. Stripped of their context, my words sounded heartless. Republican operatives made sure the clip was replayed virtually nonstop on Facebook feeds, local radio and television coverage, and campaign ads across Appalachia for months. I made this unfortunate comment about coal miners at a town hall in Columbus just 2 days before the Ohio primary. You say millions of words in a campaign and you do your best to be clear and accurate. Sometimes it just comes out wrong. It wasn't the first time that happened during the 2016 election, and it wouldn't be the last. But it is the one I regret most. The point I had wanted to make was the exact opposite of how it came out. The context is important. The moderator asked how I would win support from working-class whites who normally vote Republican. Good question. I had a lot to say about that. I was looking right at my friend, Congressman Tim Ryan, who represents communities in southeastern Ohio, suffering from job losses in coal mines and steel plants. I wanted to speak to their concerns and share my ideas for bringing new opportunities to the region. Unfortunately, a few of my words came out in the worst possible way. Instead of dividing people the way Donald Trump does, let's reunite around policies that will bring jobs and opportunities to all these underserved poor communities. So, for example, I'm the only candidate who has a policy about how to bring economic opportunity using clean renewable energy as the key into coal country. Because we're going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business, right, Tim? And we're going to make it clear that we don't want to forget those people. Those people labored in those mines for generations, losing their health, often losing their lives to turn on our lights and power our factories. Now, we've got to move away from coal and all the other fossil fuels, but I don't want to move away from the people who did the best they could to produce the energy that we relied on. If you listen to the full answer and not just that one garbled sentence pulled out of it, my meaning comes through reasonably well. Coal employment had been going down in Appalachia for decades, stemming from changes in mining technology, competition from lower sulfur Wyoming coal, and cheaper and cleaner natural gas and renewable energy, and a drop in the global demand for coal. I was intensely concerned about the impact on families and communities that had depended on coal jobs for generations. That's why I had proposed a comprehensive $30 billion plan to help revitalize and diversify the region's economy. But most people never heard that. They heard a snippet that gave the impression that I was looking forward to hurting miners and their families. If you were already primed to believe the worst about me, here was confirmation. I felt absolutely sick about the whole thing. I clarified and apologized and pointed to my detailed plan to invest in coal communities. But the damage was done. For many people, coal miners were symbols of something larger. A vision of a hard-working, God-fearing, flag-waving, blue-collar white America that felt like it was slipping away. If I didn't respect coal miners, the implication was that I didn't respect working-class people generally, or at least not working-class white men in small towns and red states. And with the clip of my comments playing on a loop on Fox News, there was basically nothing I could say to make people think otherwise. The backlash was infuriating for many reasons. For one, there was the double standard. Donald Trump hardly went a single day on the campaign trail without saying something offensive or garbling a thought. He received criticism, but it rarely stuck, with a couple of big exceptions. Many in the press and political chattering class marveled at how Teflon-coated Trump seemed to be, ignoring their own role in making him so. I got none of this leeway. Even the smallest slip-up was turned into a major event. Yet at the same time, I was routinely criticized for being too cautious and careful with my words. It was an unwinnable dynamic. But the coal mining gaffe felt terrible in ways that went beyond my normal frustrations over double standards. This wasn't some dumb comment about an unimportant issue. I genuinely cared a lot about struggling working-class families and fading small towns. I cared a lot about coal communities in particular. Not for political reasons. I knew I wasn't going to win a lot of votes in places like West Virginia, but for personal ones. I lived in Arkansas for years and fell in love with Ozark Mountain towns a lot like those across Appalachia. In fact, coal had been mined in Arkansas for decades, and Bill and I knew retired miners suffering from black lung disease. As an attorney, he had represented more than 100 of them, trying to help them get the benefits they deserved. When I got to the Senate, I worked with Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia to do what I could to support legislation to protect the safety and pensions of coal miners. I also represented once prosperous industrial cities in upstate New York, where factories had closed and jobs dried up, just like in southeastern Ohio and western Pennsylvania. I respected the defiant pride that so many who lived there felt for their hometowns, and understood the mistrust they felt toward outsiders swooping in with grand pronouncements about their lives and futures. I found that by listening, building coalitions, and helping people to help themselves, we could start turning things around and create new opportunities for businesses and jobs. So I worked with eBay to help small businesses in rural upstate communities get online and reach new customers. My office connected chefs and restaurant owners from Manhattan with farmers and winemakers in the Hudson Valley and the Finger Lakes in an effort to expand sales. And we worked with upstate universities to bring in new research grants that could help them become hubs for job-creating industries such as biotech and clean energy. I love that work because it produced results and made people's lives better. Appearing to dismiss the men and women of coal country, or any American working hard against the odds to build better lives for themselves and their families, wasn't something I could just shrug off. This really bothered me, and I wanted badly to do something about it. It's worth pausing for a moment to be clear about the bigger picture. Terms like working class and blue collar get thrown around a lot and can mean different things to different people. Generally, when academics and political analysts talk about the working class, they mean people without a college degree. But frequently, people use the term in a broader way. How much money people make, the kinds of jobs they do, the communities they live in, and a basic sensibility or set of values all get wrapped up together in our image of what it means to be working class. And there's often a tendency to equate working class with white and rural. How we think and talk about this has big implications for our politics. I came of age in an era when Republicans won election after election by peeling off formerly Democratic white working-class voters. Bill ran for president in 1992 determined to prove that Democrats could compete in blue-collar suburbs and rural small towns without giving up our values. By focusing on the economy, delivering results, and crafting compromises that diffused hot-button issues such as crime and welfare, he became the first Democrat since World War II to win two full terms. By 2016, the country was more diverse, more urban, and more college-educated, with working-class whites making up a shrinking portion of the electorate. Barack Obama had written a new playbook about how to win the presidency by mobilizing younger, more diverse voters. My campaign strategy was built on that playbook. But I still wanted to help those small towns that Bill had won 24 years before, and the Rust Belt communities like those I had represented in the Senate. Even before the campaign began, I was focused on the shocking number of poor white women and men who were dying younger than their parents because of smoking, substance abuse, and suicide, what's been called an epidemic of despair. This decline in life expectancy was unprecedented in the modern history of our country. It's the kind of thing that happened in Russia after the disintegration of the Soviet Union. Back in 2013 and 2014, I started talking about McDowell County, West Virginia, where more than one-third of the residents lived in poverty and only half had a high school degree. Jobs were scarce and drug use was rampant. McDowell County was one of the poorest communities in the country, but lots of other small towns and rural areas were also dealing with stagnant wages and disappearing jobs. Social networks that provided support and structure in previous generations were weaker than ever, with schools failing, labor unions shrinking, jobs leaving, church attendance declining, trust in government falling, and families becoming more fractured. People trying to build a future in these hard-hit communities didn't face just ceilings on their aspirations. It was as if the floor had collapsed beneath them, too. What could be done to help? I pointed to an ambitious effort in McDowell County, led by the American Federation of Teachers under President Randy Weingarten, and nearly 100 partners from the local community, government, business, labor, nonprofits, and foundations. They recognized that the problems McDowell faced with its schools, jobs, housing, infrastructure, and public health were all connected. So they had to work on all of them at the same time with new investments, fresh thinking, and lots of hard work. Their public-private partnership named Reconnecting McDowell had no guarantee of success, but I thought the effort was exciting. After a few years, it showed real results. The high school graduation rate increased from about 72% to nearly 90%, while dropout rates and teen pregnancy declined. The schools were wired with broadband, homes were connected with fiber, and every middle school student received a laptop. But even the best philanthropic effort was unlikely to turn the tide across Appalachia unless it was backed up by strong, effective policies at both the state and federal levels, something that Republicans in Congress and state legislatures never supported. Appalachian coal mining jobs had been in a long decline, but between 2011 and 2016, the bottom fell out. Nationwide, coal production fell by 27%. Nearly 60,000 coal miners and contractors lost their jobs, 40% of them in Kentucky and West Virginia alone. Big coal companies such as Peabody Energy, Arch Coal, and Alpha Natural Resources went bankrupt, threatening the pensions of thousands of retired miners. This was a crisis that demanded a serious response. There was a tension between the urgent imperative to reduce America's dependence on fossil fuels, especially coal, that were the main cause of climate change, and the need to help the communities whose livelihoods had long depended on producing those fuels. I believed it was possible and imperative to do both. As I would say later in that ill-fated town hall, we had to move away from coal, but we couldn't move away from the hard-working people who kept America's lights on and our factories churning for generations. When I launched my campaign for president in June 2015, I specifically mentioned coal country and the need to help distressed communities make the transition to a more sustainable economic future. It was a call I'd repeat in nearly every speech I gave all over the country. I also got to work developing the detailed plan to invest $30 billion in revitalizing coal communities that I mentioned earlier. Consulting with national experts and local leaders, my team came up with great ideas for new incentives to attract jobs and industries to Appalachia, improving infrastructure and broadband internet, training programs that would lead to real jobs instead of worthless certificates, and more support for schools and students. We also worked with the United Mine Workers of America Union on steps to hold the coal companies accountable and guarantee health care and a secure retirement for miners and their families. I spoke out publicly when the union said it would be helpful, and I exerted pressure behind the scenes when needed. In the end, Peabody Energy, one of the biggest coal companies, agreed to extend benefits for more than 12,000 retired miners and their families. If I had won the election, I would have used the full power of the federal government to do even more. No other candidate came close to this level of attention to the real challenges facing coal communities. On the left, Bernie Sanders advocated for leaving all fossil fuels in the ground, including coal. On the right, Donald Trump made promises about reopening mines, but offered zero credible ideas for how he'd reverse decades of decline and job loss. So it was frustrating and painful that, thanks in large part to my one unfortunate comment and opposition in West Virginia to President Obama's executive order mandating a reduction in carbon dioxide emissions, both of those candidates were far more popular in the state than I was. A few weeks after my gaffe, I went to Appalachia to apologize directly to people I had offended. I knew it was unlikely to change the outcome of the upcoming West Virginia primary or the general election in November, but I wanted to show my respect. I wanted to make it clear that I would be a president for all Americans, not just the ones who voted for me. Prominent Democrats in West Virginia suggested I fly in and out of Charleston and make a speech in front of a friendly audience. My team on the ground liked that. It would take the least amount of time away from my packed campaign schedule and would mean a warmer reception than I was likely to receive in more rural parts of the state. But that wasn't what I had in mind. I wanted to go deep into the southern coal fields to communities facing the biggest challenges, where Trump was most popular and my coal miner gaffe was getting the most attention. As one of my advisors put it, that would be like Trump holding a rally in downtown Berkeley, California. That's pretty much what I was going for. We designed a trip that would take me from eastern Kentucky to southern West Virginia to southeastern Ohio, concluding with an economic policy speech in Athens, Ohio, with my friend Senator Sherrod Brown, who was also on my list of potential choices for vice president. We started in Ashland, Kentucky, where I met with a dozen steelworkers who'd lost their jobs when the factory where they'd worked for decades closed. I also talked with men who worked on the railroads and watched as the decline of coal and steel production led to reductions in rail service, which in turn cost more jobs and further isolated the region. I had known going into the campaign that many communities still hadn't recovered from the Great Recession, and a lot of working-class Americans were hurting and frustrated. Unemployment was down, and the economy was growing, but most people hadn't had a raise in 15 years. The average family income was $4,000 less than when my husband left office in 2001. I knew this backward and forward. When I got out there and heard the deep despair, those numbers became ever more real. I listened to people talk about how worried they were about their kids' futures. A lot of men were embarrassed that they depended on disability checks to pay the bills and that the jobs they could find didn't pay enough to support a real middle-class life. They were furious that after all they'd done to power our economy, fight our wars, and pay their taxes, no one in Washington seemed to care, much less be trying to do anything about it. Usually, when I meet people who are frustrated and angry, my instinctive response is to talk about how we can fix things. That's why I spent so much time and energy coming up with new policies to create jobs and raise wages. But in 2016, a lot of people didn't really want to hear about plans and policies. They wanted a candidate to be as angry as they were, and they wanted someone to blame. For too many, it was primarily a resentment election. That didn't come naturally to me. I get angry about injustice and inequality, abuse of power, lying, and bullying. But I've always thought it's better for leaders to offer solutions instead of just more anger. That's certainly what I want from my leaders. Unfortunately, when the resentment level is through the roof, your answers may never get a hearing from the people you want to help most. We left Kentucky and crossed into West Virginia. Just as I remembered from 2008, there was very spotty cell phone coverage as we drove into the Mountain State. That drove the traveling team nuts, but I was thinking more about the bigger problem of how the lack of connectivity hamstrung businesses and schools and held back economic development. Nearly 40% of people in rural America don't have access to broadband, and research shows those communities have lower incomes and higher unemployment. That's a solvable problem and one I was eager to take on. I thought back to how much I loved campaigning in West Virginia during the 2008 primary when I won the state by 40 points. My favorite memory from that primary was celebrating Mother's Day with my mom and daughter in the small town of Grafton, West Virginia, where the holiday was invented 100 years earlier. It was one of the last Mother's Days I ever had with my mom, and it was a great one. We drove into Mingo County, arguably ground zero for the coal crisis. In 2011, there had been more than 1,400 miners in the county. By 2016, there were just 438. Our destination was the town of Williamson, home to a promising public-private partnership similar to Reconnecting McDowell that was trying desperately to marshal the resources and the political will needed to expand and diversify the local economy as well as improve public health. After about 3 hours, we arrived at the Williamson Health and Wellness Center. It was drizzling, but outside on the street was a crowd of several hundred angry protesters chanting, "We want Trump," and "Go home, Hillary." Many held up signs about the so-called war on coal. One woman explained to a reporter why she was supporting Trump. "We're tired of all the darn handouts. Nobody takes care of us." Another had painted her hands red to look like blood and kept yelling about Benghazi. Standing with them was Don Blankenship, the multimillionaire former CEO of a large coal company who was convicted for conspiring to violate mine safety regulations after the Upper Big Branch mine explosion killed 29 workers in 2010. He was due to report to prison just days later, but he made time to come protest me first. I knew I wouldn't get a warm welcome in West Virginia. That was the point of my trip, after all. But this level of anger took me aback. This wasn't just about my comments in one town hall. This was something deeper. Since the election, I've spent a lot of time thinking about why I failed to connect with more working-class whites. Many commentators talk as if my poor showing with that group was a new problem that stemmed mostly from my own weaknesses and Trump's unique populist appeal. They point to the white voters who switched from Obama to Trump as evidence. West Virginia, a heavily white working-class state, tells a different story. From Franklin Roosevelt's election in 1932 to Bill's re-election in 1996, Democrats won 14 out of 17 presidential elections there. Since 2000, however, we've lost every time by increasingly bigger margins. In 2012, Obama lost to Mitt Romney by nearly 2-1. It's hard to look at that trend and conclude that it is all about me or about Trump. The most prominent explanation, though an insufficient one on its own, is the so-called war on coal. Democrats' long-standing support for environmental regulations that protect clean air and water and seek to limit carbon emissions has been an easy scapegoat for the misfortunes of the coal industry and the communities that have depended on it. The backlash reached a fevered pitch during the Obama administration, despite strong evidence that government regulation is not the primary cause for the industry's decline. The Obama administration was slow to take on this false narrative. When it was getting ready to announce the sweeping new Clean Power Plan, which was seen as the most anti-coal policy yet, I thought the president should consider making the announcement in coal country and couple it with a big effort to help miners and their families by attracting new investments and jobs. That might have softened the blow a little. In the end, President Obama announced the new regulations in the White House alongside his administrator of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA. That was seen by many folks in West Virginia as another signal that Democrats didn't care about them. Once that perception takes hold, it's hard to dislodge. That said, Democrats' problems with white working-class voters started long before Obama and go far beyond coal. After John Kerry lost to George W. Bush in 2004, the writer Thomas Frank popularized the theory that Republicans persuaded whites in places like West Virginia to vote against their economic interests by appealing to them on cultural issues. In other words, quote, gays, guns, and God, unquote. There's definitely merit in that explanation. Remember my earlier description of the man in Arkansas who said Democrats wanted to take his gun and force him to go to a gay wedding? Then there's race. For decades, Republicans have used coded racial appeals on issues such as school busing, crime, and welfare. It was no accident that Ronald Reagan launched his general election campaign in 1980 with a speech about states' rights near Philadelphia, Mississippi, where three freedom riders had been murdered in 1964. In 2005, the chairman of the Republican National Committee formally apologized for what's been called the Southern Strategy. But in 2016, it was back with a vengeance. Politics was reduced to its most tribal, us versus them, and them grew into a big list. Blacks, Latinos, immigrants, liberals, city dwellers, you name it. Like so many demagogues before him, Trump encouraged a zero-sum view of life, where if someone else is gaining, you must be losing. You can hear the resentment in the words of that protester in Williamson. We're tired of all the darn handouts. Nobody takes care of us. It's hard to compete against demagoguery when the answers you can offer are all unsatisfying. And years of economic pain provided fertile ground for Republicans' cultural and racial appeals. Union membership, once a bulwark for Democrats in states like West Virginia, declined. Being part of a union is an important part of someone's personal identity. It helps shape the way you view the world and think about politics. When that's gone, it means a lot of people stop identifying primarily as workers and voting accordingly, and start identifying and voting more as white, male, rural, or all of the above. Just look at Don Blankenship, the coal boss who joined the protest against me on his way to prison. In recent years, even as the coal industry has struggled and workers have been laid off, top executives like him have pocketed huge pay increases, with compensation rising 60% between 2004 and 2016. Blankenship endangered his workers, undermined their union, and polluted their rivers and streams, all while making big profits and contributing millions to Republican candidates. He should have been the least popular man in West Virginia even before he was convicted in the wake of the death of 29 miners. Instead, he was welcomed by the pro-Trump protesters in Williamson. One of them told a reporter that he'd vote for Blankenship for president if he ran. Meanwhile, I pledged to strengthen the laws to protect workers and hold bosses like Blankenship accountable. The fact that he received a jail sentence of just 1 year was appalling. Yet I was the one being protested. Some on the left, including Bernie Sanders, argue that working-class whites have turned away from Democrats because the party became beholden to Wall Street donors and lost touch with its populist roots. It's hard to believe that voters who embrace Don Blankenship are looking for progressive economics. After all, by nearly every measure, the Democratic Party has moved to the left over the past 15 years, not to the right. Mitt Romney was certainly not more populist than Barack Obama when he demolished him in West Virginia, and Republicans are unabashedly allied with powerful corporate interests, including the coal companies trying to take away health care and pensions from retired miners. Yet they keep winning elections. During my visit, the Republican majority leader in the U.S. Senate, Mitch McConnell from Kentucky, was blocking West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin's legislation to protect coal miners' pensions. Why? Senator Brown said it was because he doesn't like the United Mine Workers Union, which endorsed his Democratic opponent in 2014. Yet there was virtually no anti-Republican backlash, and to date, no political consequences for one of the most callous displays of disregard for the needs of coal miners I can remember. Now, I've met a lot of open-minded, big-hearted men and women who live and work in poor rural communities. It's hard to fault them for wanting to shake things up politically after so many years of disappointment. But anger and resentment do run deep. As Appalachian natives such as author J.D. Vance have pointed out, a culture of grievance, victimhood, and scapegoating has taken root as traditional values of self-reliance and hard work have withered. There's a tendency toward seeing every problem as someone else's fault, whether it's Obama, liberal elites in the big cities, undocumented immigrants taking jobs, minorities soaking up government assistance, or me. It's no accident that this list sounds exactly like Trump's campaign rhetoric. But just because a situation can be exploited for political gain doesn't mean there's not a problem. The pain and panic that many blue-collar whites feel is real. The old world they talk wistfully about, when men were men and jobs were jobs, really is gone. Don't underestimate the role of gender in this. In an economy where most women don't have any choice but to work, and few men earn enough to support a family on their own, traditional gender roles get redefined. Under the right circumstances, that can be liberating for women, good for kids, and even good for men, who now have a partner in shouldering the economic burden. But if the changes are caused by the inability of men to make a decent living when they want to work and can't find a job, the toll on their sense of self-worth can be devastating. It all adds up to a complex dynamic. There's both too much change and not enough change, all at the same time. When people feel left out, left behind, and left without options, the deep void will be filled by anger and resentment, or depression and despair, about those who supposedly took away their livelihoods or cut in line. Trump brilliantly tapped into all these feelings, especially with his slogan, Make America Great Again. Along with that were two other powerful messages. What have you got to lose? And she's been there for 30 years and never did anything. What he meant was, you can have the old America back. Once I vanquish the immigrants, especially Mexicans and Muslims, send the Chinese products back, repeal Obamacare, demolish political correctness, ignore inconvenient facts, and pillory Hillary, along with all the other liberal elites. I hate all the same people you do. And unlike the other Republicans, I'll do something to make your life better. When my husband was a little boy, his Uncle Buddy in Hope, Arkansas liked to say, anybody who tries to make you mad and stop you from thinking is not your friend. There's a lot to be said for thinking. Like so much wisdom I've heard in my life, it's easier to say than to live by. The far easier choice is to play the pin the tail on the donkey blame game, which is what has happened to Democrats in too many places. One of the most important but least recognized facts in American politics is that Republicans tend to win in places where more people are pessimistic or uncertain about the future, while Democrats tend to win where people are more optimistic. Those sentiments don't track neatly with the overhyped dichotomy between the coasts and the heartland. There are plenty of thriving communities in both blue and red states that have figured out how to educate their workforces, harness their talents, and participate in the 21st century economy. And some of the most doom and gloom Americans are relatively affluent, middle-aged, and retired whites, the very viewers Fox News prizes. While many poor immigrants, people of color, and young people are burning with energy, ambition, and optimism. As an example, in 2016, I got whacked in Arkansas as a whole, but I won Pulaski County, home of Little Rock, the state's vibrant capital city, by 18 points. I lost Pennsylvania, but I won Pittsburgh with 75% of the vote. Trump may think of that city as an emblem of the industrial past. He contrasted it with Paris when he pulled out of the global climate agreement in 2017. But the reality is that Pittsburgh has reinvented itself as a hub of clean energy, education, and biomedical research. As I saw when I campaigned there many times, people in Pittsburgh are determined and optimistic about the future. So I can't say what was in the hearts and minds of those men and women standing in the rain in Williamson chanting, "Go home, Hillary." Did they despise me because they'd heard on Fox that I wanted to put coal miners out of business? Did some think I turned my back on them after they'd voted for me in the Democratic primary in 2008? Did they turn against me because I served as Obama's Secretary of State and believed climate change was a real threat to our future? Or did their rage flow from deeper tribal politics? All I knew for certain was they were angry, they were loud, and they hated my guts. I gave them a big smile, waved, and went inside. Dr. Dino Beckett, the director of the Williamson Health and Wellness Center, was waiting for me, along with about a dozen locals and Senator Joe Manchin. They were eager to tell me about how they were working to turn around their struggling community. They had started an incubator to help local entrepreneurs get new small businesses off the ground. The county was trying to turn abandoned mining properties into industrial parks that could attract new employers. They knew they needed better housing infrastructure, so they put people to work refurbishing homes and businesses. They realized that many of their neighbors were struggling with opiate addiction and other chronic health issues such as diabetes, so they opened a nonprofit health clinic. A recovering drug addict who had become a counselor told me how meaningful the work was, even if stemming the epidemic of substance abuse was a Sisyphean endeavor. To make sure I heard a cross-section of perspectives, Dr. Beckett had invited a laid-off coal worker he knew from their children's school soccer team, Bo Copley, along with his wife, Lauren. Bo was a Republican and a fervent Pentecostal with a T-shirt that said, hashtag Jesus is better. He lost his job as a maintenance planner at a local mining operation the year before. Now the family was getting by on what Lauren could earn through her small business as a photographer. When it was Bo's turn to speak, his voice was heavy with emotion. "Let me say my apologies for what we've heard outside," Bo began, with the chants of the protesters still audible. "The reason you hear those people out there saying some of the things that they say is because when you make comments like, 'We're going to put a lot of coal miners out of jobs,' these are the kind of people that you're affecting." He passed me a picture of his three little children, a son and two daughters. "I want my family to know that they have a future here in this state because this is a great state," he said. "I've lived my entire life here. West Virginians are proud people. We take pride in our faith in God. We take pride in our family and we take pride in our jobs. We take pride in the fact that we're hard workers." Then he got to the heart of the matter. I just want to know how you can say you're going to put a lot of coal miners out of jobs and then come in here and tell us how you're going to be our friend, because those people out there don't see you as a friend." "I know that, Bo," I replied, "and I don't know how to explain it other than what I said was totally out of context from what I meant." I badly wanted him to understand. I didn't have a prayer of convincing the crowd outside, but maybe I could make him see that I wasn't the heartless caricature I had been made out to be. I said how sorry I was and that I understood why people were angry. "I'm going to do everything I can to help," I told him. "Whether or not people in West Virginia support me, I'm going to support you." Bo looked at me and pointed to the photograph of his children. "Those are the three faces I had to come home and explain to that I didn't have a job," he said. "Those are the three faces I had to come home to and explain that we're going to find a way, that God would provide for us one way or another, that I was not worried and I had to try to keep a brave face so they would understand." He said that earlier in the day he had picked up his young son from school and suggested they stop to get something to eat. "No, Daddy," his son replied, "I don't want us to use up our money." It was hard to hear that. After the meeting ended, I went off to the side with Bo and Lauren. I wanted to let them know I appreciated their candor. Bo told me how he leaned on his Christian faith in a difficult time. It was everything to him. I shared a little about my faith, and for a minute, we were just three people bonding over the wisdom of the prophet Micah. To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with God. Bo was a proud man, but he knew he and his community needed help. Why, he asked, weren't there more programs in place already to help people who were ready and willing to work to find good jobs to replace the ones that had disappeared? Why wasn't there anywhere for someone like him to turn? I told him about my plans to bring new employers to the area and to support small businesses like his wife's. They weren't going to solve the region's problems overnight, but they would help make life better. And if we could get some positive results, people might start believing again that progress was possible. But I knew that campaign promises would go only so far. As we drove off for Charleston, I called my husband. Bill, we have to help these people. How do we help give people in rural counties such as Mingo and McDowell a fighting chance? The most urgent need right now is to stop the Trump administration from making things a whole lot worse. I hope by the time you hear this, Republicans will have failed to repeal Obamacare, but that's far from certain. Trump's health care plan would have devastating consequences in poor and rural areas, especially for older people and families who rely on Medicaid. And at a time when opiate addiction is ravaging communities across rural America, Trump and Republicans in Congress proposed scrapping the Affordable Care Act's requirement that insurers cover mental health services and addiction treatment. It alarms me to think about what this would mean for the recovering addicts, family members, doctors, counselors, and police officers I met in West Virginia and across the country who were all struggling to deal with the consequences of this epidemic. Beyond health care, Trump wants to eliminate nearly all federal support for economic diversification and development in coal country. He's proposed shutting down the Appalachian Regional Commission, which has invested more than $387 million in West Virginia alone, helped create thousands of jobs, and supported community efforts such as the Williamson Health and Wellness Center. Appalachia needs more investment, not less. More access to fast, affordable, and reliable broadband for businesses and homes. More high-quality training programs that do a better job of matching students to jobs that actually exist, not just providing certificates that look nice in a frame on the wall but don't lead anywhere. And incentives such as the New Markets Tax Credit that can attract new employers beyond the coal industry and build a more sustainable economy. Trump's promises are ringing increasingly hollow. After the election, he took a lot of credit for persuading the air conditioning maker Carrier to keep hundreds of manufacturing jobs in Indiana rather than moving them to Mexico. Since then, we've learned it was essentially a bait and switch. Carrier received millions in subsidies from taxpayers and is still shipping out 630 jobs anyway. That kind of bait and switch shouldn't surprise anyone who's followed Trump's career. Trump also promised to reopen coal mines and revive the industry to its former glory. But despite what he says and what a lot of people want to believe, the hard truth is that coal isn't coming back. As Trump's own director of the National Economic Council, Gary Cohn, admitted in a moment of candor in May 2017, coal doesn't even make that much sense anymore. Politicians owe it to communities that have relied on the industry for generations to be honest about the future. The entire debate over coal unfolds in a kind of alternative reality. Watching the news and listening to political speeches, you'd think coal is the only industry in West Virginia. Yet the truth is that the number of coal miners has been shrinking since the end of World War II. During the 1960s, fewer than 50,000 West Virginians worked in the mines. By the end of the 80s, it was fewer than 28,000. The numbers have gone up and down as the price of coal fluctuates, but it's been 25 years since the industry accounted for even 5% of total employment in the state. Today, far more West Virginians work in education and health care, which makes protecting the Affordable Care Act vital to protecting West Virginian jobs. Across the country, Americans have more than twice as many jobs producing solar energy as they do mining coal. And think about this. Since 2001, 500,000 jobs in department stores across the country have disappeared. That's many times more than were lost in coal mining. Just between October 2016 and April 2017, about 89,000 Americans lost jobs in retail, more than all the people who work in coal mining put together. Yet coal continues to loom much larger in our politics and national imagination. More broadly, we remain locked into an outdated picture of the working class in America that distorts our policy priorities. A lot of the press coverage and political analysis since the election has taken as a given that the, quote, real America, unquote, is full of middle-aged white men who wear hard hats and work on assembly lines, or did, until Obama ruined everything. There are certainly people who fit that description, and they deserve respect and every chance to make a decent living. But fewer than 10% of Americans today work in factories and on farms, down from 36% in 1950. Most working-class Americans have service jobs. They're nurses and medical technicians, child care providers, and computer coders. Many of them are people of color and women. In fact, roughly two-thirds of all minimum wage jobs in America are held by women. Repealing Obamacare or starting a trade war with China won't do anything to make these Americans' lives better. But raising the minimum wage would. It would help a lot. So would a large program to build and repair our bridges, tunnels, roads, ports, and airports, and expand high-speed internet access to neglected areas. Strengthening unions and making it easier for workers to organize and bargain for better pay and benefits would help rebuild the middle class. Supporting overstretched families with paid leave and more affordable child care and elder care would make a huge difference. So would a public option for health care and allowing more people to buy into Medicare and Medicaid, which would help expand coverage and bring down costs. The other thing we should be honest about is how hard it's going to be, no matter what we do, to create significant economic opportunity in every remote area of our vast nation. In some places, the old jobs aren't coming back, and the infrastructure and workforce needed to support big new industries aren't there. As hard as it is, people may have to leave their hometowns and look for work elsewhere in America. We know this can have a transformative effect. In the 1990s, the Clinton administration experimented with a program called Moving to Opportunity for Fair Housing, which gave poor families in public housing vouchers to move to safer, middle-income neighborhoods where their children were surrounded every day by evidence that life can be better. 20 years later, the children of those families have grown up to earn higher incomes and attend college at higher rates than their peers who stayed behind. And the younger the kids were when they moved, the bigger boost they received. Previous generations of Americans actually moved around the country much more than we do today. Millions of black families migrated from the rural South to the urban North. Large numbers of poor whites left Appalachia to take jobs in Midwestern factories. My own father hopped a freight train from Scranton, Pennsylvania to Chicago in 1935, looking for work. Yet today, despite all our advances, fewer Americans are moving than ever before. One of the laid-off steelworkers I met in Kentucky told me he found a good job in Columbus, Ohio, but he was doing the 120-mile commute every week because he didn't want to move. People from Kentucky, they want to be in Kentucky, another said to me. That's something that's just in our DNA. I understand that feeling. People's identities and their support systems, extended family, friends, church congregations, and so on, are rooted in where they come from. This is painful, gut-wrenching stuff, and no politician wants to be the one to say it. I believe that after we do everything we can to help create new jobs in distressed small towns and rural areas, we also have to give people the skills and tools they need to seek opportunities beyond their hometowns and provide a strong safety net both for those who leave and those who stay. Whether it's updating policies to meet the changing conditions of America's workers, or encouraging greater mobility, the bottom line is the same. We can't spend all our time staving off decline. We need to create new opportunities, not just slow down the loss of old ones. Rather than keep trying to recreate the economy of the past, we should focus on making the jobs people actually have better and figure out how to create the good jobs of the future in fields such as clean energy, healthcare, construction, computer coding, and advanced manufacturing. Republicans will always be better at defending yesterday. Democrats have to be in the future business. The good news is we have a lot of ideas to help make life better in our modern economy. As you saw earlier, I proposed a whole raft of them in my campaign. So even as Democrats play defense in Trump's Washington, we have to keep pushing new and better solutions. On that trip to West Virginia, I spent some time with a group of retired miners who were concerned about losing the health care and pensions they had been promised for years of dangerous labor, often in exchange for lower wages. One retiree told me a story that has stuck in my memory ever since. Many years ago, when he first went into the mines, he told his wife, "You're not going to have to worry. We're union. We'll have our health care. We'll have our pensions. You won't have to worry about nothing." But quietly, he still worried about his neighbors who didn't have the same benefits. In 1992, he decided to vote for the first time in his life. He wanted to vote for Bill. When his friends at the mine asked him why, he said the only reason was health care. "You've got health care. What are you worried about?" they asked. But he was adamant. "There are other people that don't have health care," he would say. And when Obamacare was finally passed, he thought it didn't go far enough. Now, some coal companies were trying to take away benefits that had been promised long ago. The security he had assured his wife was rock solid was now in jeopardy. "People need to worry about one another," he told me. "We are our brother's keeper, and we need to worry about other people. Me, personally, I have faith. I know God is going to get us through it, but we need to be worrying about our brother." Most of the folks I met in places like Ashland, Kentucky and Williamson, West Virginia, were good people in a bad situation, desperate for change. I wish more than anything that I could have done a better job speaking to their fears and frustrations. Their distrust went too deep, and the weight of history was too heavy. But I wish I could have found the words or emotional connection to make them believe how passionately I wanted to help their communities and their families. Where there is a will to condemn, evidence will follow. Chinese proverb. Those damn emails. Imagine you're a kid sitting in history class 30 years from now, learning about the 2016 presidential election, which brought to power the least experienced, least knowledgeable, least competent president our country has ever had. Something must have gone horribly wrong, you think. Then you hear that one issue dominated press coverage and public debate in that race more than any other. "Climate change," you ask? "Health care?" "No," your teacher responds. "Emails." Emails, she explains, were a primitive form of electronic communication that used to be all the rage. And the dumb decision by one presidential candidate to use a personal email account at the office, as many senior government officials had done in the past and continued to do, got more coverage than any other issue in the whole race. In fact, if you had turned on a network newscast in 2016, you were three times more likely to hear about those emails than about all the real policy issues combined. Was there a crime, you ask? Did it damage our national security? "No and no," the teacher replies with a shrug. Sounds ridiculous? I agree. For those of you in the present, you've most likely already heard more than your fill about my emails. Probably the last thing you want to hear right now is more about those damn emails, as Bernie Sanders memorably put it. If so, skip to the next chapter, though I wish you'd listen to a few more pages to understand how it relates to what's happening now. But there's no doubt that a big part of me would also be very happy to never think about the whole mess ever again. For months after the election, I tried to put it all out of my mind. It would do me no good to brood over my mistake, and it wasn't healthy or productive to dwell on the ways I felt I'd been shivved by then FBI Director Jim Comey 3 times over the final 5 months of the campaign. Then, to my surprise, emails were suddenly front-page news again. On May 9, 2017, Donald Trump fired Comey. The White House distributed a memo by Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein that excoriated Comey for his unprofessional handling of the investigation into my emails. They said that was the reason for firing him. You hear that right. Donald Trump said he fired Comey because of how unfair the email investigation was to me. Rosenstein cited the nearly universal judgment that Comey had made serious mistakes, in particular his decisions to disparage me in a July press conference and to inform Congress that he was reopening the investigation just 11 days before the election. Testifying before Congress on May 19, 2017, Rosenstein described Comey's press conference as profoundly wrong and unfair. I read Rosenstein's memo in disbelief. Here was Trump's number two man at the Justice Department putting in writing all the things I'd been thinking for months. Rosenstein cited the opinions of former attorneys general and deputy attorneys general of both parties. It was as if, after more than 2 years of mass hysteria, the world had finally come to its senses. But the story quickly fell apart. On national television, Trump told NBC's Lester Holt that the real reason he fired Comey was the FBI's investigation into possible coordination between the Trump campaign and Russian intelligence, or as Trump called it, this Russia thing. I wasn't surprised. Trump knew that for all of Comey's faults, he wouldn't lie about the law. He had insisted that there was no case against me, despite Republican and internal FBI pressure to say there was. So when he confirmed the FBI's Russia investigation to Congress in 2017, I figured he was on borrowed time. Still, it was incredible to see Comey go from villain to martyr in 5 seconds flat. To make sense of this, you have to be able to keep 2 different thoughts in your head at the same time. Rosenstein was right about the email investigation, and Comey was wrong. But Trump was wrong to fire Comey over Russia. Both of those statements are true, and both are frustrating. As painful as it is to return to this maddening saga, it's now more important than ever to try to understand how this issue ballooned into an election-tipping controversy. A lot of people still don't understand what it was all about. They just know it was bad. And I can't blame them. They were told that over and over again for 1.5 years. For most of the general election campaign, the word email dominated all others when people were asked to name the first word that came to mind about me. Right off the bat, let me say again that, yes, the decision to use personal email instead of an official government account was mine and mine alone. I own that. I never meant to mislead anyone, never kept my email use secret, and always took classified information seriously. During the campaign, I tried endlessly to explain that I'd acted in good faith. I tried to apologize, though I knew the attacks being lobbed at me were untrue or wildly overstated and motivated by partisan politics. Sometimes I dove deep into the tedious details. Other times I tried to rise above it all. Once I even told a bad joke. No matter what, I never found the right words. So let me try again. It was a dumb mistake, but an even dumber scandal. It was like quicksand. The more you struggle, the deeper you sink. At times, I thought I must be going crazy. Other times, I was sure it was the world that had gone nuts. Sometimes I snapped at my staff. I was tempted to make voodoo dolls of certain members of the press and Congress and stick them full of pins. Mostly, I was furious at myself. Given my inability to explain this mess, I decided to let other voices tell the story this time. I hope that it helps to better connect the dots and explain what did and, equally important, didn't happen. Nothing can undo what's done. But it does help with my frustration, and that's clearly good for my mental health. Quote, our best information is that she set it up as a matter of convenience. Unquote. FBI Director James Comey in congressional testimony, July 7, 2016. Yes, it was supposed to be convenient. Some doubted that explanation, but that's what the FBI concluded after months of investigation, and it's the truth. A lot of young people today are used to carrying around multiple devices and having both a personal phone and one provided by their work, but I'm not a digital native. I couldn't even have told you what that term meant until fairly recently. I didn't send a single email while I was in the White House as First Lady or during most of my first term in the U.S. Senate. I've never used a computer at home or at work. It was not until about 2006 that I began sending and receiving emails on a BlackBerry phone. I had a plain old AT&T account like millions of other people and used it both for work and personal email. That was my system, and it worked for me. Adding another email account when I became Secretary of State would have meant juggling a second phone since both accounts could not be on the same State Department device. I knew that former Secretary of State Colin Powell had used personal email exclusively. I also knew that email wasn't where the bulk of a secretary's work was done. All this added up to me not giving this much thought when I took office. There was a lot else going on, although, of course, I now wish I had. In early 2009, I moved my email account from AT&T's server to one that my husband's office had previously set up in our Chappaqua home, which is guarded by the Secret Service. People have asked, why did you set up that server? But the answer is that I didn't. The system was already there. My husband had been using an office server for years and had recently upgraded it. It made sense to me to have my email account on that same system. So I just moved my account onto it. I could keep using my BlackBerry in exactly the same way as I always had. I emailed regularly with Chelsea and with Bill's team. He does not personally use email, and we are still phone people, and with relatives and friends. But very little of my work was via email during the next four hectic years. I held lots of meetings, talked on the telephone on both regular and secure lines, read stacks of briefing papers, and traveled nearly a million miles to 112 countries to see people face-to-face. When we went back later on and collected all my work-related emails, we found a lot like this. From H. Sent Sunday, September 20th, 2009, 10:28 p.m. To John Podesta. Subject, Ray, when could we talk? I'm on endless calls about the UN. Could I call you early tomorrow? Would between 6:30 and 8 be too early? Please wear socks to bed to keep your feet warm. Yes, that's me telling my friend John to wear warm socks. Or there's this one where I struggle to use my fax machine. From H, sent Wednesday, December 23rd, 2009, 2:50 p.m. To Huma Abedin. Subject, Ray. Can you hang up the fax line? They will call again and try fax. I did. From Huma Abedin, 2H, sent Wednesday, December 23rd, 1443-02-2009. Subject, Ray, can you hang up the fax line? They will call again and try fax. Yes, but hang up one more time so they can reestablish the line. From H, Tahuma Abedin, sent Wednesday, December 23rd, 1439-39, 2009. Subject, Ray, can you hang up the fax line? They will call again and try fax. I thought it was supposed to be off the hook to work. Here's one more that still makes me chuckle. From H, sent Wednesday, February 10th, 2010, 3:19 p.m., to Huma Abedin, subject Ray Diane Watson to retire. I'd like to call her. But right now, I'm fighting with the White House operator who doesn't believe I am who I say and wants my direct office line even though I'm not there, and I just gave him my home number and the State Department number, and I told him I had no idea what my direct office number was since I didn't call myself. And I just hung up and am calling through ops, the operators, like a proper and properly dependent Secretary of State. No independent dialing allowed. In the end, what was meant to be convenient turned out to be anything but. If I had known all that at the time, there's no question I would have chosen a different system. Just about anything would have been better. Carving messages in stone and lugging them around town would have been better. Quote, laws and regulations did not prohibit employees from using their personal email accounts for the conduct of official department business, unquote. Report by the State Department Inspector General, May 2016. Sounds definitive, right? Every department in the federal government has an internal inspector general who oversees legal and regulatory compliance. The State Department Inspector General and his top aides, one of whom had formerly worked for Republican Senator Chuck Grassley, were no friends of mine. They looked for every opportunity to be critical. Yet when they examined all the rules in place when I was Secretary of State, they came to the above conclusion. There was a lot of confusion and consternation in the press about this question, in part because some of the rules changed after I left office. But as the Inspector General of the State Department spokesman confirmed, there was no prohibition on using personal email. Quote, prior to Secretary Kerry, no Secretary of State used a state.gov email address. Unquote. Karen Lang, the career diplomat responsible for managing the staff supporting the Secretary of State, in a June 2016 deposition. The use of private email didn't start with me. It also didn't end with me. Colin Powell exclusively used an AOL account. Secretary Kerry, who was the first Secretary of State to use a government email address, has said that he continued using his pre-existing personal email for official business well into 2015. None of this was particularly remarkable, nor was it a secret. I corresponded with more than 100 government officials from my personal email account, including the president and other White House officials. The IT staff at the State Department often assisted me in using my BlackBerry, particularly when they realized how technologically challenged I was. As for record keeping, because the overwhelming number of people with whom I was exchanging work-related emails were government personnel on their .gov email addresses, I had every reason to think the messages I sent should have been captured by the government's servers, archived, and made available for Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, requests. Quote, with respect to potential computer intrusion by hostile actors, we did not find direct evidence that Secretary Clinton's personal email domain in its various configurations since 2009 was successfully hacked. Unquote. FBI Director James Comey in a press conference on July 5, 2016. A lot of people suggested that the server maintained by my husband's office might be vulnerable to hacking. As it turned out, the State Department network and many other highly sensitive government systems, including at the White House and the Pentagon, were all hacked. Colin Powell's emails were hacked. But as Comey stated, there has never been any evidence that my system was ever compromised, Ironically, it turns out it may have been one of the safest possible places for my email. Quote, everybody thought Hillary Clinton was unbeatable, right? But we put together a Benghazi special committee, a select committee. What are her numbers today? Her numbers are dropping. Unquote. Republican Majority Leader Representative Kevin McCarthy on Fox News, September 29, 2015. Here's where the story takes a turn into the partisan swamp. Republicans spent years shamelessly trying to score political points off the terrorist attack in Benghazi, Libya in September 2012. It was a tragedy, and I lay awake at night racking my brain about what more could have been done to stop it. After previous tragedies, including the bombings of our embassy and Marine barracks in Beirut in 1983 that killed 241 Americans, and the bombings of our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998 that killed 12 Americans and hundreds of Africans, there were good faith, bipartisan efforts to learn lessons and improve security. But after the attacks in Benghazi, Republicans turned the deaths of four brave Americans into a partisan farce. They weren't satisfied that seven congressional investigations, five of them led by Republicans, and an independent review board conducted thorough factual reviews and concluded that neither President Obama nor I were personally to blame for the tragedy. The Republican committee chairmen had done their jobs, but their leaders weren't satisfied. They wanted to score more political points. So they set up a, quote, new, unquote, special committee to damage me as much as possible. As Kevin McCarthy, the number two House Republican, explained in his moment of rare and unintentional candor, something had to be done to hurt me. He was also trying to become Speaker and needed to impress the right wing. It wasn't until October 2015 that the Republicans finally asked me to testify. By then, the investigation into the terrorist attack had long since been overshadowed by their obsession with my emails. The Republicans running the committee had scrapped 10 planned hearings about security and other issues and instead focused solely on me. I had already testified about the attack in both the House and the Senate in 2013, so there wasn't much new ground to cover. Nonetheless, I answered questions for 11 hours. As overtly partisan as the whole exercise was, I was happy to have the chance to set the record straight. The Republicans had delivered a massive binder of emails and memos to me just before the hearing began, warning that they planned to ask about any or all of them, some I'd never seen before. The questioners tried to outdo one another in search of a gotcha moment that would play on the news. It was all a little ham-handed. One congressman pointed portentously to a paragraph in one of my emails, insisting it contained some damning revelation of wrongdoing. I directed his attention to the next paragraph, which proved the opposite, and so it went. Afterward, the Republican chairman, Trey Gowdy, sheepishly admitted the whole exercise had failed to achieve much of anything. When asked what new information had emerged over 11 hours of grilling, he paused for several seconds and then couldn't come up with anything. I was down the hall in a small conference room where I hugged my staff who had labored so hard to prepare me for the hearing. I invited them back to my house in Northwest Washington, where we ate takeout Indian food and decompressed. The press agreed that the committee was a bust for the Republicans, but I was experienced enough in the ways of Washington scandals to know that some damage had already been done. Accusations repeated often enough have a way of sticking, or at least leaving behind a residue of slime you can never wipe off. Quote, There is no question that former Secretary Clinton had authority to delete personal emails without agency supervision, unquote. Department of Justice court filing, September 2015. The Benghazi committee sent the State Department a blizzard of requests for documents. In August 2014, among 15,000 pages of emails provided to the committee were 8 emails to or from me. At the time, nobody raised any questions to me about why I was using a non-state.gov account. A few months later, during the fall of 2014, the State Department, in an attempt to complete its record-keeping, sent a letter to each of the 4 previous Secretaries of State, me, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, and Madeleine Albright, for copies of all work emails we might still have in our possession. None of the other secretaries produced anything. Nothing about weapons of mass destruction and the deliberations that led up to the Iraq War. Nothing about the fallout over the mistreatment of detainees at Abu Ghraib prison or the use of torture. Nothing at all. Madeleine said she never used email at the State Department. Neither did Condi, although senior aides of hers used personal email accounts. Powell said he didn't keep any of his emails. I directed my attorneys to collect and provide to the department any messages I had that could conceivably be considered related to official business. That came to more than 30,000 emails. They were intentionally expansive in what they determined to be work-related. The State Department and the National Archives and Records Administration later determined that 1,258 of them were, in fact, purely personal and did not need to be provided to the department. More than 30,000 emails sounds like a lot, but that's over 4 years, and a lot of those consisted of thanks or please print or no reply at all. One of my aides once calculated the average number of emails he sent and received every day. Over 4 years, it was hundreds of thousands. That helps put the numbers in context. Another 31,000 of the emails I had were personal and not related in any way to my job as Secretary of State. I got a lot of grief for saying they were about yoga sessions and wedding planning, but these messages also included communications with lawyers and doctors, information about my mother's estate, reports from family and friends about things happening in their personal lives, both happy and sad. In short, clearly private, personal content. Naturally, I didn't want strangers reading them. So we checked to make sure we were following the rules, providing every relevant email I had, and deleted the personal ones. Critics later pounced on the fact that I deleted my personal emails and accused me of acting improperly. But as the Justice Department said, the rules were clear, and they would have applied to personal emails sent on a government account as well. And for good reason. Nobody wants his or her personal emails made public. Quote, lock her up, unquote. Trump advisor Michael Flynn at the Republican National Convention, July 18, 2016. This quote could have been pulled from nearly any Trump rally of the entire campaign. But there's a certain poetic justice now in remembering how enthusiastic Michael Flynn was about sending me to jail. The endless chants of lock her up once again exposed the viciousness of the Republican smear merchants and their most devoted followers. It was all depressingly familiar. For decades, political adversaries have accused me of every crime under the sun, even murder, and promised that I'd end up in jail one day. You'd think that this history might have prompted fair-minded journalists to hesitate before setting off on another scandal jamboree, or that voters might look at a long pattern of false accusations and be skeptical of new claims. But you'd be wrong. The vaguely remembered history of past pseudo-scandals ended up reinforcing the general perception that something shady must be going on with her and fueling the much-discussed phenomenon of Clinton fatigue. Throughout the 2016 campaign, I watched how lies insinuate themselves into people's brains if hammered often enough. Fact-checking is powerless to stop it. Friends of mine who made calls or knocked on doors for me would talk to people who said they couldn't vote for me because I had killed someone, sold drugs, and committed any number of unreported crimes, including how I handled my emails. The attacks were repeated so frequently that many people took it as an article of faith that I must have done something wrong. The hysteria over emails kicked off in earnest in March 2015. On a Saturday night, my attorney, David Kendall, received an email from the New York Times asking several questions about my email practices and asking for responses by late Sunday or early Monday at the latest. We scrambled to answer as many of the Times' questions as we could. Clearly, something was up. The Times article appeared online later Monday, March 2nd, with the headline, "Hillary Clinton Used Personal Email Account at State Department, Possibly Breaking Rules." As the Inspector General's report eventually made clear, this was baloney. The Times observed darkly, "The revelation about the private email account echoes long-standing criticisms directed at both the former secretary and her husband, former President Bill Clinton, for a lack of transparency and inclination toward secrecy." It wasn't until the eighth paragraph that the story noted, "Mrs. Clinton is not the first government official or first secretary of state to use a personal email account on which to conduct official business." The Times' argument was that using personal email reinforced the narrative that I had a penchant for secrecy. But I've always found that charge odd. People know more about me and Bill than anybody in public life. We've made public 38 years of our tax returns, 38 years more than a certain someone. All my State Department emails, the Clinton Foundation tax returns and donors, medical information, yet we were secretive? When we sometimes did draw a line after going further than anyone in public life to be transparent, we didn't do it to be secretive, we did it to keep ourselves sane. Not to mention that someone trying to keep her email secret would be pretty dumb to use at clintonemail.com. The facts didn't stop the hamster wheel of Washington scandal from spinning into rapid motion as other media outlets sought to follow a story that must be important because the New York Times had put it on the front page. In an effort to calm things down, 2 days after the Times article appeared, I called for the public release of all the emails I had provided the State Department. I knew that would be a level of transparency unheard of in public life. In fact, more of my emails are now publicly available than every other president, vice president, and cabinet secretary in our country's history combined. I had nothing to hide, and I thought that if the public actually read all of these thousands of messages, many people would see that my use of a personal account was never an attempt to cover up anything nefarious. The vast majority of the emails weren't particularly newsworthy, which may be why the press focused on any gossipy nugget it could find and otherwise ignored the contents. There were no startling revelations, no dark secrets, no tales of wrongdoing or negligence. They did, however, reveal something I felt was worth seeing, the hard work and dedication of the men and women of the State Department. Once people did start reading, I was amused by some of the reactions, as I always am when people discover that I am, in fact, a real person. Quote, "I was one of the most ardent Hillary haters on the planet, until I read her emails," unquote, one writer declared. "I discovered a Hillary Clinton I didn't even know existed," she continued. "A woman who cared about employees who lost loved ones, who without exception took time to write notes of condolence and notes of congratulations, no matter how busy she was, who could be a tough negotiator and firm in her expectations, but still had a moment to write a friend with encouragement in tough times," unquote. Unfortunately, most people didn't read the emails. They just knew what the press and the Republicans said about them, so they figured they must contain some dark, mysterious secrets. On March 10th, I held a press conference. It wasn't a pleasant experience. The press was ravenous, and I was rusty, having been out of partisan politics for several years. Looking back, it would have been better if I'd simply used a second email account and carried a second phone, I said. But at the time, this didn't seem like an issue. That was true. And it didn't satisfy anyone. Right then and there, I should have known there would never be some magical words to prove how silly it was and make it go away. Quote, losing the story to another news outlet would have been a far, far better outcome than publishing an unfair story and damaging the Times' reputation for accuracy. Unquote. New York Times public editor Margaret Sullivan on July 27, 2015. Late on July 23, 2015, the Times delivered another bombshell. A front-page article headlined, "Criminal Inquiry is Sought in Clinton Email Use," reported that two inspector generals had asked the Department of Justice to open a criminal investigation into whether sensitive government information was mishandled in connection with the personal email account Hillary Rodham Clinton used as Secretary of State. Now my campaign had to deal with questions about whether I was being measured for an orange jumpsuit. The Justice Department, however, clarified quickly that it had received a referral related to the potential compromise of classified information, but not a criminal referral. The Times had to publish two corrections and an editor's note explaining why it had left readers with a confused picture. Representative Elijah Cummings, the ranking Democrat on the Benghazi Committee, helped explain what happened. Quote, I spoke personally to the State Department Inspector General on Thursday, and he said he never asked the Justice Department to launch a criminal investigation of Secretary Clinton's email usage. Instead, he told me the Intelligence Community Inspector General notified the Justice Department and Congress that they identified classified information in a few emails that were part of the FOIA review and that none of those emails had been previously marked as classified, unquote. Looking back after the election, the Times described the mix-up as, quote, a distinction without a difference, unquote, because we now know that there was an investigation underway. But we also now know that there was a disagreement between the Department of Justice and the FBI about how to describe it appropriately. The DOJ's approach, reflected in the clarification to the Times story issued by its spokesperson, was intended to adhere to the long-standing policy of not confirming or denying the existence of an investigation, a rule that Comey respected scrupulously when he refused to say anything at all about the investigation into possible ties between Russia and the Trump campaign. But when it came to my emails, he had plenty to say. Regardless, the Times got into trouble because it gave its readers only one side of the story. The paper's Margaret Sullivan published a scathing postmortem headlined, "A Clinton Story Fraught with Inaccuracies, How It Happened and What Next." Sullivan took the Times to task for its shoddy reporting. Quote, you can't put stories like this back in the bottle. They ripple through the entire news system, she wrote. It was, to put it mildly, a mess, unquote. Quote, if all these respected senior Foreign Service officers and experienced ambassadors are sending these emails, then this issue is not about how Hillary Clinton managed her email, but how the State Department communicates in the 21st century, unquote. Phil Gordon, a former Assistant Secretary of State and National Security Council official, who had some of his emails to me classified retroactively in the Times, May 10th, 2016. The Department of Justice's investigation and pretty much everything else that followed turned on questions of classification. The issue was no longer using personal email on the job. The question now was what should be considered classified, and did I or anyone else intend to mishandle it? Despite its sciencey name, classification isn't a science. Five people asked to look at the same set of documents could easily come to five different conclusions. We see this every day across the government, as different agencies disagree about what information should be considered classified. When I was secretary, it was not uncommon for one of our foreign service officers, talking to foreign diplomats and journalists, to report back on political or military developments in a country and file this information in an unclassified form. But a CIA agent in the same country, using covert informants and techniques, might gather the very same facts yet classify the report as secret. The very same information. Is it classified or not? Experts and agencies frequently disagree. That's what happened when the State Department and the intelligence agencies reviewed my emails for release. Remember, I had asked for all of them to be published so that the American people could read them and judge for themselves. There were also a number of Freedom of Information Act requests working their way through the courts. The easiest thing to do would have been to just dump every email onto a website and be done with it. But the government has rules it has to follow in FOIA cases. You don't want to accidentally publish someone's Social Security number or cell phone number. When reviewing my 30,000 emails in a number of instances, representatives of various U.S. intelligence agencies sought to retroactively classify messages that had not previously been marked as classified. Many State Department diplomats with long experience conducting sensitive diplomacy disagreed with those decisions. It was like a town changing speed limits and retroactively fining drivers who had complied with the old limit but not the new one. For example, an email from Dennis Ross, one of our country's most experienced diplomats, was declared classified retroactively. It described back-channel negotiations he'd conducted with Israelis and Palestinians as a private citizen back in 2011. Government officials had already cleared him to publish the same information in a book, which he had done. But now different officials were trying to classify it. It shows the arbitrariness of what is now being classified, Dennis observed. Something similar happened to Henry Kissinger around the same time. The State Department released the transcript of a 1974 conversation about Cyprus between then-Secretary of State Kissinger and the director of the CIA. But much of the text was blacked out because it was now considered classified. This puzzled historians because State had published the full, unredacted transcript 8 years before in an official history book, and on the department's website. Another veteran diplomat, Ambassador Princeton Lyman, was also surprised to find some of his run-of-the-mill emails to me retroactively designated as classified. Quote, the day-to-day kind of reporting I did about what happened in negotiations did not include information I considered classified, unquote, he told the Washington Post. Quote, that is an absurdity. We might as well shut the department down. Unquote. Former Secretary of State Colin Powell in the Times on February 4, 2016, after learning that two messages sent to his personal email account were being classified retroactively. Like Colin, I thought it was ridiculous that some in the intelligence agencies were now trying to second-guess the judgment of veteran diplomats and national security professionals in the State Department about whether messages they sent should be classified. It was doubly ridiculous to suggest that I should have second-guessed them in the moment. Given all this, it's no surprise that many experts say that overclassification has become a big problem across the government. Even FBI Director Comey admitted as much in a Senate hearing, agreeing that a great deal of material that gets classified is, in fact, widely known to the public and poses little or no risk to national security. Comey also confirmed that none of my emails was properly marked as classified, and therefore I would reasonably conclude they were not. His full exchange with Congressman Matt Cartwright of Pennsylvania in a congressional hearing on July 7, 2016 is worth hearing. Cartwright, you were asked about markings on a few documents. I have the manual here, marking national classified security information. And I don't think you were given a full chance to talk about those three documents with the little C's on them. Were they properly documented? Were they properly marked according to the manual? Comey. No. Cartwright. According to the manual, if you're going to classify something, there has to be a header on the document, right? Comey. Correct. Cartwright. Was there a header on the three documents that we've discussed today that had the little C in the text someplace? Comey. No. There were three emails. The C was in the body, in the text, but there was no header on the email or in the text. Cartwright. So if Secretary Clinton really were an expert about what's classified and what's not classified, and we're following the manual, the absence of a header would tell her immediately that those three documents were not classified. Am I correct in that? Comey. That would be a reasonable inference. Quote, this is not a situation in which America's national security was endangered. Unquote. President Barack Obama on 60 Minutes, October 11, 2015. This wasn't just the view of the commander-in-chief. Many top foreign policy officials from both parties agreed and endorsed me for president, like Michael Chertoff, George W. Bush's Secretary of Homeland Security. She's going to do a good job protecting the country, Chertoff told NPR. In a world at war, you've got to focus on the top priority, which is protecting the United States and protecting our friends and allies. Quote, the American people are sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails. Enough of the emails. Let's talk about the real issues facing America. Unquote. Senator Bernie Sanders in the first Democratic debate, October 13, 2015. I couldn't have said it better myself. I remain grateful for Bernie's wise comment in our first debate. There was a reason the crowd cheered so heartily. He was right that the whole controversy was nonsense. If only the press had treated it that way. I wish I could end this story right here. Unfortunately, the saga continued. Quote, our judgment is that no reasonable prosecutor would bring such a case. Unquote. FBI Director James Comey in a press conference on July 5, 2016. The FBI's security inquiry was thorough, professional, and slow. My lawyer wrote to the Department of Justice way back in August 2015, repeating my public pledge to cooperate completely and offering for me to appear voluntarily to answer questions. I wanted my interview to take place as quickly as possible since the first Democratic primaries were looming, but we were repeatedly told, not yet. It became clear that I would likely be the last witness interviewed. I understood this was the logical sequence, but I chafed at being unable to dispel the cloud of uncertainty looming over me. Finally, in June 2016, they were ready to talk to me. We agreed to an interview on July 2nd, a sleepy Saturday on a hot holiday weekend. To avoid press hoopla as much as possible, We set it for 8 a.m. at the FBI headquarters in the J. Edgar Hoover building in downtown Washington. An elevator whisked me and my team up from the basement parking lot to the 8th floor, where we were brought to a secure conference room. 8 DOJ and FBI lawyers and agents were waiting for us. One of my attorneys, Catherine Turner, was 8.5 months pregnant, so there was a lot of baby-related small talk to help break the ice. The interview lasted 3.5 hours and was conducted largely by 2 FBI agents, although all the government lawyers asked some questions. They wanted to know how I had decided to use my personal email at the State Department, who I'd talked to, what I'd been told, what I knew about maintenance of the system, how I'd had the emails sorted, and other things. The agents were professional, precise, and courteous. Their questions were phrased carefully and not argumentative, and when they obtained an answer, they didn't try to badger. I thought it was conducted efficiently. When they said they had no further questions and thanked me, I apologized to them all, saying that I was sorry they'd had to spend so much time on this matter. Director Comey had not been present during my Saturday interview, but 3 days later, on Tuesday, July 5th, he held a very unusual press conference. It came as a complete surprise to us. We had no warning and had heard no feedback at all after the Saturday session. Comey made a double-barreled announcement. First, he said that no criminal charges would be brought against anyone, stating that no reasonable prosecutor would bring a criminal case of mishandling classified information in this situation. We had expected that. Nonetheless, it was good to hear those words. The second shot was both completely unexpected and inappropriate. Comey said that although my State Department colleagues and I had not violated the law about handling classified information, we, all 300 of us who had written emails later classified, were nevertheless, quote, extremely careless, unquote. He said the FBI had found that, quote, the security culture of the State Department in general and with respect to use of unclassified email systems in particular was generally lacking in the kind of care for classified information found elsewhere in the government, unquote. It was one thing to go after me, but disparaging the entire State Department was totally out of bounds and revealed how much age-old institutional rivalries between agencies colored this entire process. Much of the public and press reaction to Comey's announcement rightly focused on the overall conclusion that after months of controversy, there was no case. Critics predicting my imminent indictment were bitterly disappointed. But I was angry and frustrated that Comey had used his public position to criticize me, my staff, and the State Department, with no opportunity for us to counter or disprove the charge. I felt a little like Ray Donovan, President Reagan's Secretary of Labor, who, after being acquitted of fraud charges, asked, "Which office do I go to get my reputation back?" My first instinct was that my campaign should hit back hard and explain to the public that Comey had badly overstepped his bounds, the same argument Rod Rosenstein would make months after the election. That might have blunted the political damage and made Comey think twice before breaking protocol again a few months later. My team raised concerns with that kind of confrontational approach. In the end, we decided it would be better to just let it go and try to move on. Looking back, that was a mistake. Quote, "The director laid out his version of the facts for the news media as if it were a closing argument but without a trial. It is a textbook example of what federal prosecutors and agents are taught not to do," unquote. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein in his May 9, 2017 memo to Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Rosenstein's damning memo about Comey's handling of the email investigation may have been exploited by the Trump White House to justify firing the FBI director in a bid to shut down the Russia investigation, but its conclusions should still be taken seriously. After all, Rosenstein is a veteran prosecutor who once again proved his independence by appointing respected former FBI Director Bob Mueller as special counsel. According to Rosenstein at the July 5th press conference, Comey usurped the Attorney General's authority, violated deeply ingrained rules and traditions at the Justice Department, and ignored another long-standing principle. We do not hold press conferences to release derogatory information about the subject of a declined criminal investigation. Comey's excuse for breaking protocol and denouncing me in public was that this was a case of intense public interest. But as Matt Miller, the Justice Department's public affairs officer from 2009 to 2011, pointed out the day after the press conference, the department investigates cases involving extreme public interest all the time. He said that Comey's, quote, willingness to reprimand publicly a figure against whom he believes there is no basis for criminal charges should trouble anyone who believes in the rule of law and fundamental principles of fairness, unquote. Comey decided to go ahead with the press conference because of supposed concerns he had with his boss, Attorney General Loretta Lynch. His decision was reportedly influenced by a forged Russian document that sought to discredit Lynch. It was fake, but Comey was still concerned. More on that in the next chapter. Comey has also pointed to the fact that Lynch and my husband had a brief unplanned conversation on a tarmac in Phoenix in late June 2016 when their planes happened to be next to each other. Nothing inappropriate was said in any way, but both of them came to regret exchanging pleasantries that day because of the firestorm that followed. There's no doubt that the optics were bad, but that didn't give Comey carte blanche to ignore Justice Department policies and overstep his bounds. The implication that Lynch, a distinguished career prosecutor, was suddenly compromised and couldn't be trusted is outrageous and insulting. It's also insulting to the former Deputy Attorney General, Sally Yates, and all the other senior Justice Department officials who were in the chain of command. Unfortunately, that wasn't Comey's last or most damaging mistake. Quote, he violated every rule in the book governing the conduct of federal law enforcement officials and did so in a way that was partisan and that indubitably affected the outcome of the election, unquote. Elliot Jacobson, one of Comey's former colleagues in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York, who has served as a prosecutor for nearly 37 years, in a letter to the editor of the New York Times. On October 28th, I was headed to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, for a rally with the leaders of several major women's advocacy groups. My friend Betsy was with me on the plane. Annie Leibovitz, the legendary photographer, was along as well to snap candid photos of life on the trail. The election was just 11 days away, and early voting was already in full swing in 36 states and the District of Columbia. I was taking nothing for granted, but I was feeling good about our momentum coming out of three successful debates, strong poll numbers, and early vote projections. When we landed in Cedar Rapids, Robbie Mook, Nick Merrill, and Communications Director Jennifer Palmieri said they had some news to share. We have something to tell you, and it's not good, Jennifer said. I had a sinking feeling. Things had been going too well for too long. We were due for trouble. What now? I asked. Jim Comey, Jennifer began, and I immediately knew it was bad. We didn't have a lot of information because the internet had been very spotty on the flight. But Jennifer said it seemed that Comey had sent a brief, vaguely worded letter to eight different congressional committees saying that in connection with an unrelated case, quote, the FBI has learned of the existence of emails that appear to be pertinent, unquote, to the previously closed investigation into my handling of classified information, although, quote, the FBI cannot yet assess whether or not this material may be significant, unquote. Jason Chaffetz, the then chairman of the House Oversight Committee, immediately tweeted with glee, case reopened. Was this a bad joke? It had to be. The FBI wasn't the Federal Bureau of Ifs or Innuendos. Its job was to find out the facts. What the hell was Comey doing? I got off the plane and into the waiting motorcade, beckoning Betsy to join me in the car. What a relief to have my friend with me. By the time we finished the rally and got back to the plane, the team had learned more. I sat back down in my seat, across from Huma and Betsy, and asked Jennifer to fill me in. How much crazier could this story get? A lot. The unrelated federal investigation turned out to be the one into Huma's estranged husband, Anthony Weiner. His lawyers had turned over a laptop of his to the U.S. Attorney's Office. FBI agents from the New York field office searched the computer and found emails between Huma and me. When we heard this, Huma looked stricken. Anthony had already caused so much heartache, and now this. "This man is going to be the death of me," she said, bursting into tears. After more than 20 years working with Huma, I think the world of her, and seeing her in such distress broke my heart. I looked at Betsy, and we both got up to comfort her. I gave her a hug while Betsy patted her shoulder. In the days that followed, some people thought I should fire Huma or distance myself. Not a chance. She had done nothing wrong and was an invaluable member of my team. I stuck by her the same way she has always stuck by me. The more we learned, the more infuriating the story became. The FBI didn't ask Huma or me for permission to read the emails it found, which we would have granted immediately. In fact, they didn't contact us at all. At the time, the FBI had no idea if the emails were new or duplicates of ones already reviewed, or if they were personal or work-related, let alone whether they might be considered classified retroactively or not. They didn't know anything at all. And Comey didn't wait to learn more. He fired off his letter to Congress 2 days before the FBI received a warrant to look at those emails. Why make